From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore how our two-party system has changed over time. Ahead of the state Democratic convention in Milwaukee this weekend, we'll learn about the purpose and the preparation for the event.
These state conventions are essentially a big pep rally for the base, the party faithful, the ones who stuff envelopes, staff the phone banks.
Then we'll learn about a literacy program helping MPS kids advance their reading skills and its impact.
The impact that this is making on their belief in themselves as readers and on their belief in being able to do hard things is extremely strong.
Plus, Bubbler Talk explores the journey of a local historic cottage. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start today's show with an update from the Troubled Waupun Correctional Institution. The prison warden and eight staff members have been charged following an investigation into deaths at the facility. Four people housed at the jail have died in the last year while the prison was in lockdown due to staffing shortages. One of those men died by suicide while in solitary confinement. Another has been ruled a homicide. Those held at the prison filed a federal lawsuit late last year alleging the conditions were cruel and unusual punishment. Here's Mario Curran with Wisconsin Watch describing what he has been told the conditions are like.
I can certainly tell you from the perspective of those locked up in there, it's something that is very pervasive. I mean, I had a letter sent to me recently from somebody who was locked up talking about one of these deaths. And I don't mean to speak in vulgar or too graphic of terms, but we're talking of, you know, he was a witness to the person's body. The body was just left outside of his door as he had to eat lunch for hours and hours. It was left outside. So these sorts of images, these things are just really kind of building up on those incarcerated and often reaching a panic tone in letters they send in the calls they make.
So they left a deceased prisoner in plain view of other people who they're caring for.
That is according to somebody who's locked up who says he witnessed it. And that's part of the challenge in this, is that we're hearing so many graphic details. We have the deaths, and those are unfortunate and tragic in themselves. But we also hear from prisoners directly saying that they have either attempted suicide or are considering it simply because of these conditions and just sort of the horror of being isolated for days, weeks, months on end without really even regular access to showers. So this is something that is very, it seems to be having a very direct result on the psychological well-being of prisoners, and for good reason. I mean, I think any of us could imagine that being a pretty horrific living condition to be stuck in.
That was Mario Curran with Wisconsin Watch describing conditions at Waupun Correctional Institution, where the warden and eight corrections officers are facing charges. You can find more coverage of what's been happening at the Waupun Correctional Facility at WUWM.com. When Democrat Mordecai Lee first joined the Wisconsin legislature in 1976, working across the aisle with Republicans wasn't just commonplace, it was often necessary. Before 2011, the legislature would regularly shift between Republican and Democratic control, and elections were closely contested. Lee joined swing State of the Union host Joy Powers and Sam Woods to talk about his experience in politics and how he's seen things change over time.
I think now people view themselves as either a Democrat or a Republican and view these two parties as being pretty diametrically opposed. What was it like when you first entered politics?
It was a different world. The members of the state assembly who were Democrats ranged from very conservative pro-lifers to very liberal pro-choicers. On the Republican side, it was exactly the same. You had pro-choice, moderate Republicans all the way to very conservative or pro-life Republicans. We had the heterogeneity of really Wisconsin society. There rarely was such a thing as a party line vote or a partisan vote. because inevitably there were some Democrats who chose to take a Republican position, and there were some Republicans who chose to take a Democratic position. In other words, in those days, the parties were what Ronald Reagan called a big tent. There was lots of room for lots of people. You really had to identify who are the people who agreed with you regardless of party. Because of that, for example, when I chaired a committee, I prided myself that almost all the bills that came out of the committee passed by unanimous vote. And that, again, is sort of hard to think of nowadays. But unanimous vote wasn't necessarily that nobody was thinking about it. It was that people were upfront about, well, here's the part of the bill I like, and here's a part of the bill I don't like. And then we'd have conversations, whether one-on-one or in a formal committee meeting. Well, what would it take for you to come on board? What is the amendment that would make you feel comfortable with this bill, that would make you feel able to defend that bill in front of your constituents? And invariably, we could find that middle ground, because in those days, the cultural difference from today is that compromise was not a dirty word. In other words, if I get half a loaf and if you get half a loaf, we both walk away sort of satisfied and sort of dissatisfied.
And so how did the parties evolve over time?
Over my adult lifetime, after I left politics, we saw politics get more partisan in the sense of that the Republican Party was the conservative pro-life party, and the Democratic Party was the liberal pro-choice party, and that a pro-life Democrat would not feel at home in the Democratic Party, and a pro-choice Republican would not feel at home in the Republican Party. Now, the negative development of this sort of increased partisanization was not only starting to demonize the other side. In other words, we're from such and such a party, and those people from the other party, they're the enemy. They're the devil. They want to destroy the Wisconsin culture that we know and love. I mean, we're talking about very, very heated passion. With that kind of demonization and that kind of ideological purity in both parties, the word compromise became a dirty word, because to compromise was to be a sellout. To compromise was to give up on your principles. And so increasingly, one sees in Wisconsin politics up to this day, party line votes on absolutely everything in the state legislature. And similarly in Washington, it's almost like they don't even need to be there on the floor of the state legislature, because the debate has no function, amendments have no function, and the predictable outcome is the only thing that matters. And so, in a sense, why schlep to Madison for the sake of a preordained outcome, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat?
At the same time, it does seem as though if you are someone who has a couple positions that maybe don't fit with Republicans or a couple positions that don't fit with the Democrats, you kind of have to bend your own feelings in order to fit into one box or the other, because there's very little room in the middle for you.
There's no doubt that the phenomenon of our lifetime is the disappearance of swing voters here in Wisconsin. You know, when we have elections for president, the last two elections for president, and 3 million to 3.5 million Wisconsinites vote, and in 2020, 20,000 decided we'd go Democratic, and 4 years before that, 20,000 decided we'd go Republican. That shows you how fixed the camps are. And one of my concerns is that the way partisan politics plays out, according to Wisconsin election laws, is that primaries, where the voters decide who's going to be the nominee of the Republican Party and who's going to be the nominee for that district from the Democratic Party, partisan elections in Wisconsin aren't working, because we know that in a general election, whether it's a partisan office or a nonpartisan office, majority rules. Sooner or later, somebody's going to get a majority. Now, it might be by a sliver of a percent, but it would more than the other person. The problem with partisan primaries, like we're going to have in August here in Wisconsin, is that the winner of the party's nomination, whether it's the Democratic primary or the Republican primary, is not chosen by the majority of the voters, is simply the person who got a plurality of the votes. So let's say there are five people running for the Republican nomination for X or the Democratic nomination for X. Well, the winner of the primary is the person who got more votes than the other four candidates. And the winner of the primary might have gotten, 30% of the votes, 35% of the votes. But that would be more than anybody else. So suddenly, the 30 percenter is the Democratic nominee or the Republican nominee, and in one party district, they'll win in November and they'll go to Madison. And to whom will they owe their loyalty? They'll owe their loyalty to the 30% of the people who voted in that party's primary in August. And then that becomes the appeal of going for the far right in a Republican primary and the far left in a Democratic primary. And so there are no moderates anymore. Being a moderate means you lose your primary and you lose the general election.
Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former Wisconsin legislator. He spoke with Joy Powers and Sam Woods for WUWM's Swing State of the Union podcast. You can hear the full episode on party politics at WUWM.com or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also tune in tomorrow at noon right here on 89.7 WUWM.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mayan Silver. Wisconsin Democrats are gearing up for their state political convention this weekend. J.R. Ross is here to give us a preview. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. Welcome, J.R. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So the Republican National Convention is getting a lot of attention locally. It'll be held in Milwaukee, but the Democratic National Convention will not be far off. It's in Chicago this year. Wisconsin Democrats are having their state political convention this weekend. What are you looking out for?
A couple of things. One, you're going to see Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker come in and speak. National Chair Jimmy Harrison come in and speak. I mean, look, these state conventions are essentially a big pep rally for the base, the party faithful, the ones who stuff envelopes, staff the phone banks, encourage their friends to turn out and vote. Like, these are the ones who are the lifeblood of the party. So just like for Republicans in Appleton back in May, for Democrats in Milwaukee in June, it's all about kind of giving a little bit of a burst of enthusiasm for the long slog ahead, because we've got several months of the election. There's a lot of work ahead. They're going to try and drive messages about what they want to do, get the base excited, and kind of look forward to the positive message toward this fall as you're ready for, you know, the negative ads to fly and all the craziness to happen.
Well, and with the Republican State Convention, you were talking about several things that you were looking for. What was going to happen with the delegates or the committee yep. man and committee woman? Are you looking for those kinds of same things here?
There are races for members of the Democratic National Committee this year. That'll be interesting to watch to see. There are a couple incumbents. One of them is Alex Lazary, was a Bucks executive. Now he's with the Biden administration. Another Andrew Werthmann up in Eau Claire. They're both incumbents. So, you know, do they get any challenge? I think they're open seats for the spots, other two spots in the National Committee. So, but yeah, it's something worth watching. These are not, say, high-profile races. I've not heard the same kind of chatter about these being possibly symbolic of, you know, the new guard versus the old guard, like with Republicans. At the same time, you know, everything we've seen with Democrats, involving Democrats lately, any kind of big event, there has been a protest about Palestine. Will we see any disruptions at the convention? Will we see a big presence? Will there be any protests at this convention at the casino, you know, Potawatomi Casino and Hotel, that again underscores there's a split in the Democratic base about the Biden administration's approach to Israel and Palestine?
Well, recently Biden announced that he's behind a plan that he's trying to get Israel and Hamas on board with. Do you think that's having any political momentum with when it comes to protesting and things like that?
We'll see. I mean, Jill Biden was in Milwaukee last week for Festa Italiana, and her speech was interrupted several times by protesters. So, you know, there's still some energy there about that issue. I'm not sure how it will be expressed at state convention. These are usually not places where you see a lot of big protests. So it's definitely something I'm watching to see if there's, you know, a big split in the base over that issue. You know, just Tammy Baldwin, for example, getting angry. She's called for a ceasefire, but there are people unhappy that she, how long it took her to join that call. Will she get any interruptions? Will the governor, you know, just kind of watch and see how the party base responds to the folks who are in power right now.
And you've said that one of the most interesting parts of conventions for you is actually the debate around resolutions. You said that party activists get very intense about these issues, and it shows kind of the political spectrum extremes have similar suspicions, for instance, you know, about the federal government and that kind of thing. What did you learn at the GOP convention on that front, and what are you looking for at the Democratic convention?
You know, at the Republican convention, there are a lot of the usual things about abortion. What's interesting there, you have people on the stage, Republican convention, who are telling delegates, hey, I know you may feel the certain way about this issue of abortion, but we have to win elections. And if we're one to win elections, we have to maybe accept a moderate position publicly or with our leaders to win. And acknowledging this is not maybe sitting well with some of the delegates. And sure enough, you read the party platform, it talks about abortion in very uncompromising terms. So you got that. The Democrats that have not seen the resolutions yet, usually don't get those publicly until we're at the convention. But will there be a Palestine resolution? You know, if there is, how will that be debated? How will that go? I mean, just watching these things that are fracture points for the two parties, how do they play out with the party base? Now, with the Republicans, there wasn't a debate over the resolutions because they put them all into a big document. They're going to debate them, but the convention went so long that Saturday, they said, okay, we're going to pass them all en masse and go home. So there wasn't a debate with the Democrats. They've put out time aside on Sunday to have that conversation. So we'll see how deep in the weeds they get in on those issues and what are the ones that, you know, are there anything splitting the party or causing a lot of angst?
And when it comes to the presidential race, you know, beyond a convention, there's the parties and the campaign's infrastructure. You talked in a previous Capitol Notes about how the Biden campaign has been opening offices, getting staffers on the ground, 44 offices and 80 staffers, and that Republicans really aren't there yet. Is that still the case? And what are you seeing there?
From what we see, yes. You know, I just talked to Ben Wicklow, the state chair, this week, the preview convention. He was touting again the infrastructure, the number of offices. Now, you've also seen nationally the Trump campaign talk about the hall, fundraising hall they pulled in after his conviction on 34 counts in New York. They are talking about how that's spurring a lot of activity from donors. Might they then turn that into money for build infrastructure? We shall see. But as far as we can tell right now, Democrats have an advantage there. Now, go back to 2016, Trump didn't have a lot of infrastructure in Wisconsin. He didn't really have much of a campaign built around that. He still won. So it's not the end-all be-all. Infrastructure, people do indoors, they can help on the margins, but you can't beat back a tide. So if the environment favors one party or another, you're likely not going to reverse that because of your infrastructure. But if it's a close race, if it's 50-50, then that's when it counts. And right now, Democrats have an advantage there. We'll see if Republicans can make up for that with, you know, volunteers and other efforts to kind of close that gap between now and Election Day.
You're tuned into Capitol Notes. I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. Okay, we'll turn to some other big news from the week, which is that Democratic Attorney General Josh Call brought felony charges, forgery charges, against two attorneys and an aide who worked for Trump in 2020. They're accused of submitting paperwork that falsely claimed Trump won Wisconsin that year, connected to the slate of false electors. What do we need to know here?
Well, a couple of things. One, this is the first step. These three all have a initial appearance scheduled in September on these charges. It's a Class H felony, if I remember correctly. And really, it's interesting that Call, there are other states where there were these schemes to, you know, put false electors in place for Trump, and Biden won. Prosecutors in places like Georgia, Michigan, Arizona had moved much earlier than Call did on this issue. So one, Call has taken some flack from Democrats about kind of the speed at which he's gone with this case. Two, are we going to see an actual conviction here? Like, what's going to happen next? I'm really watching that. You know, there's a question from Republicans. They feel like, when I talk to them, this was all basically an effort to preserve Donald Trump's legal options when it came to challenging the results of the 2020 election, that basically, you know, Trump was in court. I think the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago on Christmas Eve rejected one case there. He had a request pending before the state U.S. Supreme Court to hear his challenge that was rejected by the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin. So there are still avenues that were all kind of active a little bit, though a long shot. So they argue this was just part of that. But if you read the indictment, the picture Call is trying to paint is that these two attorneys, especially Jim Troupas from Wisconsin and Ken Chesbrough, were basically engineering this entire scheme to overturn the results, that There's even a passage in the documents where the senior BD kind of acknowledged that Biden had won Wisconsin. They're still trying to somehow flip the state in Trump's favor. And then Michael Roman is an aide to the was an aide to Trump campaign, deeply involved in all this stuff as well. They're trying to paint these guys as really the driving force behind it. Worth noting, the 10 Republicans who signed the false elector documents were not part of those charged. They reached a civil settlement with a law firm that had sued them over their participation in that effort. Call would not answer any questions about whether they could be charged or even Trump himself, saying that the investigation was ongoing and they will follow wherever it leads. But there's, you know, kind of an interesting dynamic for Call where Republicans think he's gone overboard, but Democrats think he's basically not gone fast enough or been aggressive enough in this case. I don't know if my conversations, this issue alone really drives voters. I mean, inflation, the economy, you know, abortion are much more driving issues, it seems like, for voters. But this is definitely an issue that gets some attention and is very important for some people. And it's interesting to see, will it really play a big factor come this fall?
Do you think that given the 2024 election happening in such short order in the next 5 months, and Trump is still on the train of claiming that he won Wisconsin in public forums, do you think that there would be an infrastructure to support Trump's rejection of the results if it were to come to that in Wisconsin, or these civil lawsuits and these, you know, litigation in place would prevent future situations like that?
Well, the 10 electors who participated in the 2020 effort pledged in part of this civil settlement not to be part of the elector again. But that said, Donald Trump is not committed to accepting the results of the 2024 election. We've seen other high-profile Republicans do the same in their comments, saying they wanted to, you know, basically make sure everything was run properly before they committed to that. There's nothing that would prevent a similar scheme, like, you know, other than like you could get charged if you were part of it, you know, the penalty of what's going on right now. But if Donald Trump says that, you know, I won, I didn't lose, and that's hypothetical, right? Like, we're still a ways away from that. Like, we're still in early June. But there's not anything that's been changed electorally in Wisconsin, like legally in Wisconsin, to prevent this from happening again.
Except the precedent of these cases having been brought and the fact that it's on people's awareness, like it was a scheme that that had never been tried before. It wasn't on people's radars. And now it's been, you know, there's an awareness about this type of thing.
Definitely. Definitely. It's been brought up, like there is pushback. But let's be honest. I mean, there is a good chunk of the Republican base that sides of Donald Trump believing that he won Wisconsin, falsely believes he won Wisconsin. Like, we've had two audits that have upheld the results. Other studies have shown no widespread fraud. But if you have a base that is bought into that belief, false as it may be, I don't know it'd be that hard to find 10 people that would participate in something like this again.
All right. Well, thanks again for spelling all this out for us, JR. And thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Hey, anytime.
The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories that you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. In about 20 minutes, this week's Bubbler Talk looks into how a historic cottage built in Fox Point came to be in Fort Atkinson. But first, we'll learn about the Forward Scholars Program and how it's helping MPS kids advance their reading skills. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Next week is the end of classes for Milwaukee Public School students before summer break. Something that's always a challenge for a system the size of MPS is to meet each student's exact needs. That's where programs like Forward Scholars fill in the gaps. It's a tutoring program in MPS schools that pairs a tutor with a student for one-on-one specialized instruction. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez sat down with Dr. Carrie Strife-Stusey, Forward Scholars Executive Director, to learn about the program.
Common Ground spoke with over 130 community members and asked the community, you know, what do you want to see happen with these ESSER dollars? So this is when we were getting that COVID relief money from the government. And resoundingly, the community said reading tutoring. You know, our kids need to be able to read. So it really was a community effort and community voices that got this program started. Since then, Forward Scholars, we have become our own 501c3. And so now we are an independent nonprofit doing this work, you know, still in collaboration with Common Ground and with support and partnership with them. But we also partner heavily with the Milwaukee Public Schools. And so the ESSER funds were 2 years worth of tutoring. And now we know that moving into the future, we're working on contracts directly with MPS. And part of that process includes figuring out which schools we're going to be at. And so the schools, when they were first selected, were built upon partnerships that were already existing in the community. So which schools could we go to where there were organizations that were already partnered, where we could have tutors that would want to go to that school and build that relationship? We also look at which schools have students that might not otherwise get access to this tutoring, because our tutoring really is a form of high dosage intervention. And so when kiddos get that in kindergarten through third grade, we know that it makes a huge impact. And then if kids are reading by the end of third grade, they're most likely to graduate from high school. And so we really look at data at schools to make sure that we are getting into schools that might not necessarily have support already in place for those kindergarten through third grade kiddos.
In a place like Milwaukee, tutoring feels specifically important. And I know there's been a lot of talk about students falling behind after the pandemic, but that kind of erases the fact that there was an opportunity gap to begin with racially, which has seemingly lasted forever. So if you could just talk about why it matters in a place like Milwaukee.
So the complexities of being in an urban city are large, and the opportunity gap has been around for decades, probably more than that, but that's how long I've been studying it. And so it's important that rather than just admiring that problem, that we do something to disrupt it. And that's really what Forward Scholars is here to do. I'll tell you right now, trying to find people with reading licenses, reading teacher, reading specialist licenses is really challenging. So when you think about a district with 70-ish, hopefully that number's right, elementary schools, it's nearly impossible to get a high quality reading teacher, reading specialist in every school, you know, even if there was funding to be able to support that. So what Forward Scholars does is we really partner with the district to work together to provide that expertise and to create a program that can fill that gap that's really challenging to meet when you're in a large urban district like Milwaukee.
I would love to talk about the volunteers since we're kind of talking about those and the people that are in the classroom and doing this kind of training. Can you kind of tell me about the training that they go through and what are you looking for?
So when it comes to the tutors, and I'll give a double look, because our tutors are our volunteers, and those are the people that are working one-on-one with the kids and delivering the instruction. But I'm going to back up just a minute to say that we also hire certified teachers that are site coordinators. And it's another unique component of our program is that each school has a site coordinator that is on site and who not only pre-assesses and assesses kids along the way, progress monitors kids, but they are the ones that are writing the individualized lessons for kids and making sure that all of the materials are prepped for our tutors. So our community volunteers are overjoyed, to put it mildly, with our program, because we hear, compared to other experiences that they've had, that it's a place that's uber organized and where they feel like they can really be effective. So when those tutors walk through the door, they pick up a bin for their kid. It has an individually written lesson plan. It has all of the materials prepared for them, and they're ready to go. There's no pre-prep. There's nothing they have to get ready. And then the other benefit of the way the program is structured is that that certified teacher, that coach, is in the room for every single session. And so what I tell tutors when they're contemplating whether this is a good fit for them is there's two requirements. Number one, they need to want to make a difference for a child. And number two, they need to be willing to ask questions, because if they're willing to ask questions, they have someone there to support them with everything that they need.
You sent me to Escuela View, where I talked with some of them and the site coordinators, and I just want to play a little tape here.
All right, you guys, I'm going to pass out your reading certificate so you can see how much you've grown over the year.
I'm Megan Miner. We are at Escuela View in Walker's Point, Milwaukee. Every day we take four groups of students, anywhere from like 4 to 7 kids. And for an hour, our tutors are working with them on reading skills, writing skills, even conversational skills. And basically, we're here to help students who are currently reading below grade level, and we're trying to help them get to or above grade level.
Fruit with whipped cream, and then take 2 to 3 books, okay?
We think there was a mistake on the instruction guide.
What?
It said we could come to the snack table one time.
Yeah.
That can't be right.
Sorry.
That can't be right.
You know, a lot of the students that we work with are coming in like 2-3 grade levels behind where they should be reading. I saw a kid really figure out how to channel his anger. And I think that was one of the main reasons he was struggling with reading, is because he was so emotional and hard on himself. And we just, at Forward Scholars, we're big on like growth mindset, and it's okay to make mistakes. And so when he was with us, he's just constantly hearing like it's okay to make mistakes, and we actually love that. And so I think he just kind of like got a little bit more comfortable with that. And he went from a K-5 to mid-third. And he's in third grade, which is amazing, because next year we won't be able to work with him as he's moving off to fourth grade. So I just feel like so much more confident where he's at now.
This is your reading progress. Look at what you had September to November. You knew 46 out of the words.
82.
And at the end of the year, what'd you get?
96.
Ah, that's so great. My name's Linda Bunton. I'm a Forward Scholars tutor, and I hadn't tutored before. Didn't know quite what to expect, but Megan, our site coordinator, was fabulous in helping us every step of the way, and I loved the little girl that I tutored. She was just a lot of fun. I'm going to miss her next year. It's just fun to see the kids learning and that you're actually doing some good. And you can see the results. It's just very satisfying. The kids are fun. I loved every bit of it. Congratulations. You did such a great job this year.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
You know, you talked a bit about your background as an educator, and specifically with this age group. Can you tell me what you saw as the literacy needs for students in Milwaukee?
So I was a kindergarten, first, second, and third grade teacher in Milwaukee, and I was actually a literacy coach too. After that, I spent 11 years in Wauwatosa as a reading specialist. So I feel really lucky that I have really in-depth and broad experience with kids in kindergarten through fifth grade. And I will say, being a teacher in Milwaukee is unique. And so one of the big pieces that I saw and that I felt when I was a classroom teacher in MPS in those early grades was that there were many of my students who didn't have the opportunity to engage meaningfully with books with adults. They had adults that cared deeply about their success, but some of their adults weren't necessarily readers or literate themselves. Some of their adults worked 2 or 3 jobs. Some of their adults worked when they came home from school. So as much as these grown-ups in their lives, as much as they want their kiddos to succeed and to be their best, that opportunity isn't always there. And so one of the benefits of Forward Scholars is that one-on-one relationship. We've found the impact of that is almost indescribable. There are kids that come to school more because they know they're going to get to see their person. there's kiddos that smile more because they know that someone is there consistently that cares about them. There's kiddos that engage with books outside of school because we send home books with them and we tell them that you're a reader wherever you go. And they have access to that book every day and they can talk to someone at home about the book they're reading. I mean, there's just so many ways that Forward Scholars addresses pieces that are challenges in, you know, in an urban district.
And I think I would just unfortunately leave us about how does funding look coming up? Because as you had talked about, there's a partnership with MPS, which is going through some extreme internal strife, just delayed a vote on their next year's budget, which is calling for the loss of hundreds of jobs across the school district. So what does the future look like for the program and what should we expect with Forward Scholars moving forward?
Thank you. Thank you for bringing up this important piece of the puzzle. So these first 2 years that we've been in existence, we have been funded through those ESSER funds. So as the community can imagine, we head into a challenging territory in the next school year as well as the school years to come. I'm really happy to say, though, that because of our strong results, so after our first year in existence, so a year of tutoring, our students grew on average over a year and a half of reading in less than 9 months of tutoring. And what we're looking at for this year, our data looks even better this year. At mid-year, kids had grown a full year of reading and less than a half of a year of tutoring. And we're looking at data being at least 2 years of growth in reading by the end of this year. So yes, our data speaks for itself. And I want to point out too that that's quantitative data, but we also do take qualitative data with the kiddos. We do a survey. And the impact that this is making on their belief in themselves as readers and on their belief in being able to do hard things is extremely strong. And so there's so many more pieces to the puzzle, you know, even than just that data. But because of the strong results that we have, because of that, we have a strong partnership with MPS. And when you think about serving students with less teachers next year, it only exacerbates the importance of having tutoring and having our program in schools for kiddos that might not have as many adults in that school that are there for instructional purposes. So number one, it's pointing out how much more we are needed in schools for next year. But number two, I'm very confident that working with the administration and MPS that we will be supported because of our results, but also because of the strong partnerships that we build with schools.
That was Forward Scholars Executive Director, Dr. Carrie Strife-Stusi. She spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. And if you're interested in becoming a volunteer tutor, you can find that information at wuwm.com. In about 10 minutes, we'll bring you the latest Bubbler Talk, which explores the journey of a historic cottage. But first, if you've ever hummed along to the Oscar Mayer Wiener song, you'll want to stick around.
The Wiener song is identified as one of the longest-running, most important advertising jingles in the advertising business. But its origin story is just remarkably simple, and that's what makes it a great story.
We'll tell you about its Wisconsin origins next on Lake Effect on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Many of you will recognize this jingle. It's become so ubiquitously known that there are few of us who can't hum along. The song was composed right here in Wisconsin, and you can find a piece of that history at the Wisconsin Historical Society, the banjo ukulele on which the song was composed. Joe Kapler is the lead curator with the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share more.
So I'd like to just dig into what's really at the center of this story, the Oscar Mayer Wiener jingle. It's probably one of the best known jingles in history. How did it come to be written?
Like a lot of great stories in history, and it's true, the Wiener song is identified as one of the longest running, most important advertising jingles in the advertising business. But its origin story is just remarkably simple, and that's what makes it a great story. Richard Trentlage was an ad man in Chicago and had spent years in the business working for some of the big firms and started his own firm called Adversonic. They worked on advertising campaigns, but especially in the jingle end of things, because Richard was naturally musically inclined. He had a way with words and a way with crafting melodies. One afternoon, Richard gets a frantic call from his business partner at Adversonic and says, "Hey, J. Walter Thompson," which was then the largest ad company in the country, "they are soliciting jingle pitches for Oscar Mayer out of Madison, Wisconsin. I asked Richard, can you crank something out? And it's due by 9 a.m. tomorrow morning." Okay, you know, it's kind of a tall order. Oscar Mayer had a major presence in Chicago. It was founded in Chicago. Richard actually worked at an Oscar Mayer facility in Chicago as a young man. So he had a familiarity with the company and a familiarity with the product. And it didn't take him very long to land on kind of the opening hook, "Oh, I wish I were an Oscar Mayer Wiener." So it didn't really take him that long that afternoon to come up with most of the lyrics and the really cute, catchy, hooky melody. Later that evening, had the kids at dinner learn the lyrics. His kids, David and Linda, who were 10 and 9 at that time. And then his wife, Vivian, could play stand-up bass. And they worked it through that evening and cranked out a demo tape in-house, at home, that simple, with the family, done in hours. Drops it off the next day at J. Walter Thompson, and then never hears a thing, forgets all about it. Over a year later, Richard hears, "Hey, congratulations, you're the finalist. You've been selected. And we would like to be able to record, professionally record the jingle, and please bring your talent with you." "My kids?" You know, that was the talent. So, you know, kind of a really charming, folksy start to it.
Interestingly, his instrument of choice was kind of unusual. It was the banjo ukulele. Can you tell us a little bit about this instrument, which is now in the Wisconsin Historical Museum?
The reason the Wisconsin Historical Society knows so much about the origin story and the importance of the Oscar Mayer Wiener song is that the society now possesses and shares the instrument on which the Oscar Mayer Wiener jingle was worked through, was written, was crafted, and ultimately recorded. And that's called a banjo ukulele. So a banjo body and a ukulele head. And instrument that became popular in the 1920s and 1930s in the United States as Hawaiian music became popular during that era. So it is a simple instrument, and it would be the right tool, so to speak, for working through creating jingles, creating hooky little songs. So in 2009, Richard Trentlage donated to the Historic Society here, of course, with Oscar Mayer being headquartered out of Madison for nearly 100 years, appropriate home for it. And it's a very popular piece in our collection, as you might imagine, because of the nostalgia and the memories that it conjures up for so many people. And it was there at home. It was there in the studio. And it's those notes played on that simple little instrument that have been heard by millions and millions and millions of people since 1963.
Well, that gets to this idea of the legacy of this song. Of course, it was on air for decades. What would you say is the legacy of what's affectionately called the Wiener song?
A legacy of the Wiener song is one of those crystal examples where the power of message can move a lot of products, but sometimes they move into the popular culture. And in the 1960s, when this came out, radio stations were receiving all kinds of requests to play that again, as if it were a hit song. But it's a commercial. you know, bands requested the music, high school bands, marching bands played it. It just went viral before we used that term. So a legacy of that and why that persisted over the decades is because it was the right type of jingle for the right type of product. There is a warmth to it that people still connect, whether they like hot dogs or they dislike hot dogs.
All right. Well, Joe, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing this story.
You're very welcome. Our pleasure.
Joe Kapler is the lead curator with the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can check out the banjo ukulele at the Wisconsin Historical Museum in Madison.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Susan Betts. I'm standing on one of Fox Point's more elegant spots. Barnett Lane is situated on a bluff overlooking Lake Michigan.
A lot of these residents who built homes on the bluff were very civic-minded in many ways, including Cronsage.
That's Douglas Fraser, a recent village president. He's talking about Fox Point's first president, Theodore Cronsage.
Cronsage was actually a very important person. He was a trial lawyer. He specialized in utilities. He served as president of the Board of Regents, served as president of the Public Service Commission. As I mentioned, was village president from 1926 to 1931.
But it's Cronsage's house in Fox Point that got this Bubbler Talk story going. Years before he became village president, Cronsage built a house on a five-acre stretch of bluff. Fraser says Cronsage's house disappeared years ago.
That was probably torn down between 1958 and probably 1980.
But some 60 miles west of Fox Point, in Fort Atkinson, a mirror image of Cronsage's long-ago home still stands. David Covey discovered the connection in the home of his great-grandfather, built around 1915. As Covey and his wife started restoring the house,
the administrator informed us that the blueprints were in the house and we found them. And it took us a while to figure out that they weren't really, well, they were for the house, but they originally were owned by Theodore Cronsage or the architect Euling.
The blueprints read, "Plan for a cottage for Mr. Theo Cronsage, O.C. Euling, architect, August 23rd, 1906. Covey's great-grandfather, George Becker, followed the same plans that were used for Cronsage's home, although Covey's family's Dutch revival had some differences.
When you see the original blueprints, yeah. I mean, it was a little fancier.
For instance, the Cronsage house in Fox Point called for
speaking tubes between the floors. I'm assuming he was going to have staff to wait on him. I could find no speaking tubes in this house. I think when George called for help, the kids had to come running.
But Covey has never been able to solve the mystery.
How my great-grandfather had ever gotten these blueprints and how he could have possibly known Cronsage.
I'm here to see Dana.
Let's see if it's Dana. Okay, give me a minute. We'll see if we can find her.
As it turns out, the two houses are likely connected because of the architect behind the design, O.C. Euling. He graduated from University of Wisconsin in 1900. 2 years later, he was making a name for himself in Milwaukee. Euling designed homes, schools, a knitting factory that still stands in the city's third ward. The list goes on. He also had a connection to Fort Atkinson.
So I did a lot of digging.
That's Dana Bartelson, assistant director of Fort Atkinson's Historical Museum.
I noticed one of the church designs that he did looks like our St. Paul's. So then I looked in our card catalog and I found, lo and behold, he was the architect for our church.
The church Euling designed still stands magnificently in downtown Fort Atkinson. Bertelson thinks architect Euling got to know Covey's great-great-grandfather, John Valentine Becker. The Beckers were respected masons and orchestrated the construction of many buildings in and around town. Bertelson suspects Euling might have passed along the Fox Point Cronsage House design to Becker.
I'm just wondering how well these men knew each other. Maybe there was a further friendship and connection. Maybe. I need a paperwork.
Bertelson intends to keep digging. However Becker and Euling connected, it resulted in twin homes, one in Fox Point and one that lives on in Fort Atkinson.
Support for Bubble Talk comes from UW Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubbletalk to submit your question.
You can hear new episodes of Bubbler Talk Thursdays on Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Xgrit Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Lena Tran, Mayan Silver, and Susan Benz from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reedy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a conversation with the president of the Rails to Trails Conservancy, an organization working to bring hiking and biking trails to cities around the country, including Milwaukee. Plus, we'll explore the rise in Delta 8 products in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.